Welcome to In Conversation with David Goa. Last November, I was invited to animate a roundtable conversation in the Faculty of Divinity at Necmettin Erbakan University in Konya. Konya was the home of the great Sufi mystic Rumi, and the Faculty of Divinity has a large professoriate and around 2,000 students, mostly women. In my roundtable remarks, I discussed American evangelical Christianity, including its current role in American culture. Several of my remarks resonated with Professor Ulich, professor of Islamic philosophy, and the author of a number of books largely on the Sufi tradition of Islam. We met following the round table and discussed the gifts and challenges facing Turkey, and indeed our larger world. Professor Ulich is a keen observer of Turkey, a fine professor who has a deep interest in his students and in education in Turkey. Some context is important to understand what continues to unfold in Turkey and Professor Ulich's concerns. When the Ottoman Empire ended following the First World War, Mustafa Kemal Atatürk founded the Republic of Turkey and became its first president in 1923. His political party led the modernization of Turkey and ushered in a secular state that modeled itself after elements in France following its revolution in 1789. Religion was removed from its central place in Turkish culture. Many religious leaders were executed, some banished, and others went underground. Fine contributions were mixed with virulent ones, as is so often the case with sweeping social change. With the election of Erdogan as prime minister, along with his Justice and Development Party in 2003, another set of remarkable changes were ushered in. I have visited Turkey a number of times in the last decade and appreciated many of these changes. I have also been a critic of how the Western press characterizes the changes coming about in Turkey. The fears expressed show little appreciation for this remarkable country and no understanding for its distinct form of Islam and its potential role in the modern world. I welcome you to my conversation with Professor Ulich, in which he speaks forthrightly about the institutional changes brought about recently in Turkey, particularly those in religious education. It is a fluid situation, and one I think we need to understand.
Welcome to In Conversation with David Goa.
You were at Hartford. You studied with Ibrahim, huh?
Yes.
Ibrahim Aburabia.
At the time, we had a combined PhD program with Turkish Academy of Sciences. I was doing my PhD at that time.
When was that?
In 2002.
2002, yeah.
And I spent with them, I was supposed to spend actually one full year, but I was not able to do that. I did not have the patience and endurance enough. My family was in Turkey at that time. So I had to come back a bit earlier than my previous plan.
So you were talking about, you said in Turkey we have...
Yes, a speedy transformation. Yes. For instance, we have opened a lot of religious high schools, a lot of theology faculties. There are now theology faculties over 100. And our prime minister himself is valuing the graduates of religious high schools.
He values the graduates of the religious high schools.
Yes. And they are trying to encourage the families to send their kids to such schools, but I am also coming from the same background, but my daughter this year started studying at medical school. Actually, I asked her, just recommended her to study at theology faculty. And, you know, one of my colleagues also, you know, requested or recommended his son to study. He said, I am already fed up memorizing the Quran at religious high school, so I cannot continue with it at theology faculty also. So, you know, I am giving these examples or mentioning these topics because the general level of religiosity in Turkey is not very high. It's not higher than before, at least, you know. It's going down, actually. You know, if you look at the, we have these some scales of religiosity, and we have professors here who are expert in such issues, and they are doing their interviews, questionnaires, and they are themselves discovering. And our government is also alarmed to that danger, you know, in terms of ethical, moral decadence.
So let me just probe this a little bit. What is the education like in the religious high schools? How would you characterize it?
You know, actually they are, that's an old story. They are since the time of Ghazali in the 12th century. He himself, you know, masterminded that kind of combined education. You know, it's, he tried to incorporate logics into Islamic sciences.
Right.
As an Aristotelian tools to right. study, and what is the criterion of
right.
scientific knowledge or demonstrated knowledge. Burhan, they call it in Arabic. And now at the 19th, early 19th century, they tried to modernize the old madrasas by adding some scientific disciplines into the Islamic sciences. So our high school students are studying both mathematics, biology, chemistry, and all other stuff, materials. In addition to this, they are studying Islamic sciences like how to recite the Quran and Hadith, the sayings of the Prophet, Quranic exegesis, Islamic jurisprudence, Islamic theology, etc., etc. And they are also studying Arabic, trying to study Arabic. And Arabic is a great obstacle to our students. They hate Arabic, our students, and theology faculty students, you know. You know, because our government, I wrote an article actually about that, you know, thinks that if somebody speaks Arabic, okay, he has done everything. That's the legitimacy of someone's authority and knowledge is, you know, almost totally, if not totally, you know, relying on his knowledge of Arabic.
Isn't that interesting? So if they speak Arabic, they obviously have deeply understood the Quran. They obviously have a special relationship to the Prophet Muhammad, peace be upon him, simply because they've learned the language.
Yes, that's what they are thinking. That's the way they think. And that's why our, for instance, at our theology faculties, they introduce a new program, international program. It's 100% Arabic. They are not studying Arabic. They are studying in Arabic as a medium of education. And I am vehemently against this. They are saying that we are bringing some students from Arab countries and we teach them and we send them back enlightened, illuminated. But, you know, it works other way, actually. They are enlightening us. They ask us, they expect us to teach in Arabic. Actually, I can teach in Arabic, but I don't want to teach in Arabic because we don't have the curricula, syllabus for that. For instance, if we teach history of religions and if we try to teach Christianity and the Arabic, when we look at the Arabic literature in the field, they are written from an apologetic way, not from a comparative way.
From an Islamic apologetic way.
Yes, I would say.
And probably that. Also from a very particular Islamic apologetic way.
Exactly, you know, as they say, oh, the people of book, let's come together around a common word.
That's right,
you
I know
heard
this.
Last night.
Yeah. I know this, yes.
And actually, we have a Turkish scholarship on this, and we have a methodology which is universal and international.
On the common word?
No, not on the common word. On the scientific, you know, principles. We have some professors who are, like you, students. They studied with Mircea Eliade. We have a very strong scholarship and tradition in history of religions. But if we teach in Arabic,
you don't have it.
Yes, we cannot teach as we teach in Turkish. And now we are bringing some Arab professors from all over the world, and they are inculcating their own little ideologies. Unfortunately, you know, a very strict interpretation of Sunnism. Excuse me, he's our chair. He's an enlightened person also. That's a problem, you know. If, on the other hand, when the West, you know, clamps down on the present.
Can we just stop for one moment there, and let me just ask you one thing about what you just said, and then I want to follow up with this issue of the West and what the implications are. So do I understand well, are you suggesting that this move towards giving Arabic the preferential option, seeing it as, in a way, it is the apex of the Islamic world, that this brings with it a very particular understanding of Islam, which in fact is quite foreign to Turkey?
Yes, we can term it like that, which is quite foreign.
I mean, I have thought, and as you're well aware, my knowledge is limited about this, but I have, on the one hand, when I saw the opening in Turkey to religious education and what have you, I thought this is an interesting moment because in my view, my limited understanding, Islam in Turkey is very different than Islam in the Arab world, in its sensibilities and in the kind of context in which it sits. It occurred to me that, the influence in Turkey of the mystical traditions of Islam, they have a quite different sensibility than Wahhabism. And so I wondered if this change wouldn't work the other way around, that in fact the very generous understanding of Islam in Turkey historically, the preoccupation in, and again I say this out of my great ignorance, my sense is that the understanding of, for example, the place of beauty in Islam in Turkey, that's a large part of Islam in Turkey. My sense in Saudi Arabia, and again, I've never been there, I know, I read about it a bit and what have you, but my sense is that the kind of understanding of Islam and the preoccupations there have largely been born out of the kind of reforms of Wahhab, and it always has struck me as very similar to a very particular kind of evangelical Protestantism and what that did to Christianity.
Puritanism.
It's a kind of Puritanism. And so instead of the beauty of God, you get the justice of God standing alone. Yeah. Instead of an understanding of the spiritual journey as being a great human struggle, you get a sense that all you have to do is live the law. So you are suggesting that my notion that this change would lead to Turkey and Turkish Islam to have an effect on the Arab world, which I thought would be very fruitful. And you're suggesting that, well, we don't know about this, but you see the other thing happening now.
You know, you saw last night we had a guest there.
Yeah.
And the way he spoke, you were witness to it.
Yes.
He is a teacher of physics at one of such religious high schools.
Yes.
He is a teacher of physics.
That's right.
And, you know, I am not interested in the way people are dressed in their beards or mustaches or sweat. But it is symbolic of something.
Boy, this is interesting. Let me give you another parallel. This is so interesting. In a number of evangelical and fundamentalist schools in North America, they also have developed a deep interest in science. They are very suspicious of the humanities,
philosophical thinking, exactly. historical thinking, and they would not engage any theological thinking outside of their own particular denominational slice of the pie. But they like science because they think it is objective, they think it never changes, they think it is proof. They can find proof there for their particular take on the theological understanding. So that's how it's working. Isn't that interesting?
Yeah, they are using science as an handmaid.
Yeah.
You know, the problem also lies in the fact that the intellectual qualities, IQs, of our such students who are attending Imam Hatip schools, it's going down and down and down and down. You know, unfortunately, we used to have 15 years ago here very brilliant students, and each year our level is going down, unfortunately.
Why?
Why? Because, you know, it is ironical, actually. The government is paying attention to such schools, investing a lot of monies and converting other schools into religious high schools, you know, and they are, I will not say they are enforcing, I will not say they are forcing the parents to select this selective religious classes, but they are at least, you know, I don't know how to say, encouraging them to do that. If a director does not encourage the parents to do that, they want to remove him from his position, as if they are imposing. But it backfires, I will say, unfortunately, in this context. Because we are, you know, the religion of the religion itself as a concept, as an institute, loses its ability to give people a meaning in life. Unfortunately, you know, it is not anymore a meaning for our life. So
government, it just becomes abstractions and justifications for our ideology.
It is old-fashioned.
I see.
Religion is old-fashioned. It has no place in the popular culture. Government, you know, and state institutions are just, you know, trying to put it in the culture from outside. It has no place in it. For instance, my daughter, you know, she is not interested in such things. She just wants to study at medical school or engineering school. And unfortunately, the poor people, they are sending their kids to such schools, and their options are very limited.
So are you suggesting that also within the society, there is really the development of two very different cultures?
Unfortunately, yes. And my daughter says that, for instance. She has 200 classmates in the first year of their class, you know, that's their first year. She says that the students, female students who are covering their heads, are on one side and the other ones on the other. So we can see the segregation. You know, we see that they are interacting, etc. My daughter herself, she does not cover her head, by the way, though I want her to do. But I did not impose upon her anything. And we see that. Actually, in Istanbul and in Ankara and in other big cities, government is trying to build up some, you know, exemplary religious high schools. They are teaching English and doing the education 100% in English. And it works somehow, you know. People, parents sending their smart kids there, but they are very limited in number. The rest, you know, nobody cares about them. So the government is now in a crisis. They just changed the Minister of Education. The new one is a Kemalist guy.
Mm.
He is a pedagogue, a professor.
Mm-hmm.
And he is now confused also.
Mm.
He doesn't know what to do.
What to do?
Yes, how to deal with the present education problem, you know. Now, because my wife is also a teacher of religion, until this year, they did not celebrate Atatürk's death day or the establishment of 29th October, Republican Day.
Mm-hmm.
But this year,
they did.
They did.
I saw that.
Because of the minister.
So that's what's happened.
Yeah, they are reversing the now, Erdogan himself, our president, he himself sees the necessity to do that because he's not happy with his comrades, with his, you know, people.
So you have thought deeply about these matters. What should be done?
I think the government, there is no government. You know, everything relies on charismatic and on one charismatic leader. If you look at our students' Facebook profiles, they are all putting our president's picture there. And we are all praying that may God give him a longer life. I think we need to strengthen our institutions. But unfortunately, that new presidential system undermines the institutional character of the state. Institutionalization is very important, but unfortunately, for instance, we used to have some elections, and now everything is directly related to our president, he himself. And he is trying to do his best, but everything depends on one person, doctor. That's a problem. I will give you an example. That building behind us, we had a fight with our rector because of that building. He wanted to get rid of us, faculty, as a whole. Because he thinks that he is a graduate of religious high school. He knows religion far better than us. We are heretics. He holds the Orthodox Islam. We don't know. He knows. And he says that I want to send you to other campus over there on the hill. And everybody has a connection to Erdogan here. They just reached him and he secured the building of that new building for our faculty here. Everything, you know, everything is directly related to our president. And, you know, other problem is that there's a distribution of power. Religious communities, so-called religious or NGOs. I am referring you humbly to read a book on Suhreverli by Kamer el-Huda, what was Striving for Divine Union.
Ah, yes.
I'm referring because Suhreverli is establishing the model for the cooperation, I would say, or collaboration or whatever, distribution of power between the mystic Sufi orders and the state.
Right, yeah.
He modeled that. Mm-hmm. And then, in the following years and centuries, the system has been continued on his model. So the problem also lies with quality, you know. Our students, our people, if somebody does not have a community, religious community, he cannot get anywhere. High positions are parceled.
I see.
Distributed.
Yeah.
And somebody thinks and believes that he cannot get a position with his own academic or whatever merits. So people are trying to get closer to such power bases. The same happened with FETÖ, a terrorist organization now. But who encouraged that? If somebody wanted to be attracted somewhere, he needs to get a reference from them. They did. And we were at that time also Turkish nationalists. I describe myself as a Turkish nationalist, but I'm a universalist Turkish nationalist.
Right. So did I understand you? So this kind of role that the NGOs play and the way in which they really have access and can ostensibly make appointments,
pushes people into the labs of such communities.
Right. And this is part of what's behind the Gulen movement.
Yes, and now, you know, we have another religious community or communities. Mm-hmm. If somebody wants to get a position at police organization, at universities, at different ministers, it's like an iceberg. He is over there. He is not representing the state itself. He represents his community there. And that's like an agreement, you know.
So it's identity politics. It's identity politics.
It's identity politics, but the community is also gives its support in return for economic, political, and other interests they are getting. So, you know, I will say that, unfortunately, you know, something else which is very bitter. We have technical high schools. These technical high schools students are really industrious and very intelligent students, smart students, and they are coming from middle class mostly. And that's the only, doctor, only I can say, or most important means of vertical movement between the layers of society. They can go up to higher positions in society through their education and merits, but our, I would say, government tried to destroy them also and to drag them to religious high schools also. So they want to destroy everything and level it, make it smooth, you know. It doesn't want such things. So who is going to build your unmanned vehicles if you turn everything into theology faculties or religious high schools? And we are also having problems at theology faculties, you know. We are teaching philosophy, as you termed, sociology and other humanities. 3 or 4 years ago, they tried to get rid of us, to get rid of that, you know, disciplines from the curriculum of theology faculties. They tried to convert us, to transform us. So we resisted, and then they opened alternative Islamic sciences faculties.
I have heard a little bit about this, that part of the argument was, since everything that is significant is in the Quran, nothing that isn't in the Quran, or anything that isn't in the Quran, isn't significant. So why do you need to study philosophy? Why do you need to study these other things?
And unfortunately,
so this it's a kind of, we have this strain in Christianity of a deep kind of scriptural literalism, and an assumption, which has always struck me as so curious, an assumption that the divine word which we receive on the page, that there is nothing that happens between the divine word on the page and our ear and the context in which our mind and heart have been shaped. In a sense, it's an assumption that there is no interpretive act. That's always found, I've always found that utterly amazing. In the Christian tradition, where there are lots of people that, well, there are some anyways, that actually view it that way. And that has also struck me about the Wahhabist tradition, that this is functioning very much the same way. I can't imagine that having the capacity to endure for very long. I mean, it may continue as a small movement, but it is so out of touch with what is happening in the larger society.
Yes.
And it's, to me, it is so tragic, because my view is that the insights of religious traditions into what the human nature is, into why we exist, questions of meaning and purpose, that those insights, they have the capacity to move across time and space. They are agile enough to help people in many different circumstances. But when you reduce them to some narrow kind of set of images or set of behaviors and set of beliefs that isn't large enough for a human life.
Exactly.
It's a very, very problematic manner. So tell me, you said something the other day when we were talking that I was a little bit startled by, and I want to find the right way to raise it. You talked a little bit about your sense that quite a number of students are vulnerable to radicalization. Now, I think I mentioned to you, I think this was in the context of some of the work I've done in Canada, where I looked at the profile of a number of students that, a number of Muslims that had been radicalized, and realized that they had all gone through the Canadian school system. Many had gone to Canadian universities. Most of them studied engineering or science or business. Very few of them studied the humanities, but they'd all gone to the public school system.
And I have a critique, of course, of what has happened to the humanities in my country and what has happened in the public school system. My sense, just quickly, is that the humanities has become captive of a particular narrow set of methods and theories: postmodernism, postcolonialism, first stage feminism, things of that nature. So in a sense, the humanities has been reduced to a concern about power, about ethnic identity, about gender issues, and about class. And so that the, and these are critical issues, and all of them are important as critical issues. But when you reduce the humanities to that, you don't open up for people what I would call the gifts of the civil life and what I would call the gifts of the religious life. They learn nothing about the beauty of the religious tradition. They only learn about its diseases. So you said that you are concerned that students are becoming vulnerable to these large or these sort of totalitarian packages that are marketed largely on the internet.
For instance, I can give an example about that. Our students were not segregated according to gender 4 years ago. Now they are segregated.
In all classes?
Yes, in all classes. Male students in a classroom, female students in other classroom. And, you know, that's really humiliating for me. I am telling our rector, why don't you segregate your medical school students? Are we not a university? Are we not a part of the secular system? Alhamdulillah, we are. I am telling him.
So this is
outraging him.
This is being done in the theology faculties.
Yes. And some administrations of theology faculties, they are resisting. And I will give another example. We used to have a canteen downstairs, lounge. Now it's this, they removed it because they dig their building, you know, they are building, constructing a building, new building, so it is not there anymore. But they also segregated our canteen for men and women. That is really shameful. I take it as shameful. Number three, one of our professors, he is now, you know, fired, telling our female students, what the hell are you doing here? You should go back to your homes and produce babies. It is forbidden for you, in Islamic law, which is not, to study here. That is a professor here receiving his money, salary, from theology faculty. He was here until, you know, very recently. And he sent his son to Pakistan and got killed there. Or Syria, I'm not sure where. Such people should not have a place here. And we also have some Arab professors here. We have an Islamic philosophy professor. He's from Yemen. He's a nice person. He has an enlightened mind. Of course, he's facing some resistance from students against philosophy and against maybe his personality also. And other professors, Arab professors, tell him that he should make repentance. He should come back, return to the orthodox understanding of Islam. You know, he is an heretic. They call him a heretic. He brought the message he received from his Arab colleagues. The Syrians, I will say. And our rector, our government is encouraging, I will say at least, our theology faculties to employ them.
You also have concerns about the way in which the West is responding to Turkey and what the implications of that are.
First of all,
what do you see there?
You know, it doesn't contribute to the betterment of the situation. First of all, I will say that. Because, as you know, in politics, in international relations, if a foreign and external outsider power tries to intervene or encroach upon a nation, upon a country, they will resist. Mm-hmm. And it will...
It creates fear?
It doesn't create fear.
No.
It will strengthen the...
Creates an opportunity.
I will say it will solidify.
It fortifies.
It fortifies, yeah. it fortifies the people, and it will decrease the voices of criticism
within the country.
Yes,
because they will be identified with the foreign power.
Exactly.
Wow. Mm.
And you know, it will help. I will say the government to act more freely, which is not in favor of them also. So they will not need to. You know, we used to have more democracy 3 years ago because of the attempted heinous criminal coup attempt. Because of that, you know. And now they just took away all our democratic rights. 3 years, you know, since for the last 3 years, we are in the state of emergency, something like that.
Yeah, emergency law.
Emergency law, They are just, you are. They say you are fired. You are fired, you are fired, you are fired. That's it. And you need to demonstrate that you are one of our two or three colleagues here. They did time in prison and they said, sorry, we are mistaken. Release them. They said your phone is, you know, confused. They say you use Bylock, and then they say, no, you did not use. And he spent 1 year and his psychology is broken down and he hates all of us, his colleagues. He says, why it happened to me? This is his psychology. Why you did not support me? How can we support? We are afraid of our own ass. And, you know, so we need to open the way, doors of dialogue. And also, you know, we need to send our kids, our students to the West. I want them to see eyewitness contact, but it is really difficult for our students to get visa and other difficulties. I think they need to open the gates for our younger generations.
So there are things
very important.
There are things we can do in the West. So let's speak about that briefly. What should we be doing?
You know, I think,
I mean, in the modest ways that we are in universities and what have you, the modest things we can do. What should we be doing?
We need to revivify and revivify our relationship with West through the Erasmus program, for instance.
Right.
And that generation was really different. Our students, if they go to the West, they see their level of education. They cannot speak English. They don't know the word. When they see, for instance, not even British or German or Austrian or French, let's talk about Romanian, Bulgarian, Polish. When they see them, they are getting shocked. You know, they say, wow, we are really back. We need to develop ourselves, improve our skills. And when they come back, they see that their position in the society is really marginal. If they don't improve themselves, not only theological studies, they need to improve themselves in terms of humanities in general. So, you know, first of all, we need to open the door that looking towards the West, not to the East. Unfortunately, I will say that. That's bitter, but I need to say that. Our students should learn English. They need to have an access to the outside world. I want to give an example. As just as you, I'm saying the Western society is under the influence of the mass media's propaganda, we are the same.
Of course, yeah.
In our own terms. So, for instance, they said that when, let's say, we shoot down the Russian aircraft, our nationalistic feelings were up, rampant. But then they said that it is our mistake. It is our mistake, and they changed language. And we need to give our generations, young generations, younger generations, that we might be also mistaken.
Yes.
You know?
Yeah.
Not the whole world is against us. Not the whole world is our enemy. We need to teach them. But for this, they need to go abroad and to see the world, that Turkey is not the center of the world. Yeah. And our theology faculty is not the center of the country. So we need to, you know, give them a universal awareness, I think they call it. And we need to send as many as as many students as possible to Western countries. We need professors, quality professors. But so I'm trying to encourage our students to learn English or any other Western language, but English is more important. It's a lingua franca. And other religions and cultures, you know, let's forget about the Western or Christian traditions. Even they think Mu'tazila, the non-Sunni, non-Orthodox. They say, why are you talking about that? Our students say.
Yeah.
Are not they heretics?
Yeah.
They are the most rationalist theologians in the Muslim world. They are brilliant. So, you know, our students need to read or need to study Islamic sciences in a comparative way, in a critical way. You know, when I don't mention Imam Abu Hanifa or Imam Azam, the biggest Imam Abu Hanifa, they say, why are you not giving him his due respect? I think we need to broaden the areas of relationship. And another problem is we don't have a Turkish academic diaspora in the West, in arts and humanities. For instance, Arabs, they have. Persians, they have. Even Palestinians, they have a lot. Yes. But we don't have.
Well, that's interesting, yeah. Mm-hmm.
Unfortunately, we don't have. We are self-enclosed. And our students are not open. They don't need to study English, actually. They don't need to study Arabic in a deeper way. They are happy with their life here in Turkey, even in Konya. That's, you know, we need to open their minds and eyes. And we are trying to give them, you have an international, a universal mission, can I say, to represent Turkey.
Mm-hmm.
I am saying, yes, we should represent, but we need to think about what we are representing in a critical way also. We cannot say we are all right and you are wrong and just fight and defend our position. That's not the issue. I am telling my students. I'm telling them they are coming from different European countries. Your father tried very hard to cross the boundary to go to Europe.
That's right, yes.
Myself, you know, I saw the TV in my childhood first at a, you know, Turkish worker's house. You know, we cannot forget that.
Yes.
We saw the blessings of life first with them. They brought, you know, from Germany, from other countries. Our standard has risen because of that. So I'm telling our such, we have a lot of such students. They were brought by Diyanet, by presidents of religious affairs. I'm telling them, why are you producing only footballers and singers, and why don't you contribute to us? We need you to study Islamic science in a comparative way. I'm encouraging them to study history, religion, sociology, and philosophy. They say, I want to study Quranic exegesis. So what? What shall you do? We have a lot.
Wow.
You can study in addition to, you know, such humanities. And I have big expectation from such students, Doctor.
We only have a couple minutes left. You have to go, I think. I have become very fond of Turkey. Privilege I've had of coming here a number of times over the last couple of years. So I would like to finish this by, and I know that you love Turkey. Say a little bit about what you see as some of the gifts of Turkey and what you would hope for over the next 20 years. You have told me the challenge. What would you hope for?
You know, I'm going to talk also about one more time about politics. We have some other parties, but the president, what he did, he manipulated other parties. For instance, Nationalist Movement Party, I supported them. And they would have a general election to change their president, their leader. And they did. And Erdogan abolished the decision of the court. And he kept the leader there.
The one he'd been working with.
Yes. And he is now paying back to him. in support. At the night of elections, he says that I am giving support to you in return for nothing. Are you a religious foundation? You are a political party. Why don't you have any demands? And there's another party. He emasculated its leader also. So Turkey is largely a conservative country, and we have three conservative parties. He brought all of them under his own influence, I would say, the least. So we cannot move, you know. So for the, you know, upcoming 20 years, actually, I don't know what will happen. We should have hope, but if the present situation continues, the political situation continues, I cannot say very nice things. Because the alternatives are also blocked.
Yes.
What can we do? I think that it is a very good step on the part of our government to restart its talks with the European Union.
Mm-hmm.
It's very good for us.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
And it's also good to change the hostility language.
Mm-hmm.
It's good also.
Mm-hmm.
The tension is going down.
Mm-hmm.
If it goes like that, I think the clamp will be released.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
For instance, I am telling my students, he is a leader of religious community and he is coming from Europe. He says, I don't want to work for a Muslim in France. I want to work for a Christian French because he is more moral. He pays me on time, and if I do overwork for 5 minutes, he also pays it. I'm saying, so well, who is more moral? You or we or them?
That might also be true of the atheist French businessman who would pay you on time too. Well,
so we need to give such people the doctor,
right,
to see the reality.
Yeah, yeah.
If they see the reality, it will change little by little. But if the pressure comes from the West, it will not help us. It will make
that's
worse,
yeah,
and more
that's
difficult.
Part of the responsibility of people like me to do everything we can do to see that the West does not just push deeper into the corners, which it has a habit of doing.
You know, we need friends from the West.
Of
a lot.
Course, yeah.
Really, we need.
Yeah, of course.
And Turkey, and I just learned that 70% of the economic investment in Turkey is coming from European Union. It doesn't come from Pakistan, from Indonesia, from Saudi Arabia.
70%, huh?
Yes, 75%.
Well, that means something.
Yeah.
Yeah, that means something. You and I both, we play the long game. It's a good American expression, huh? The long game. We get to teach students.
Yes.
And so I can be pretty pessimistic about the world sometimes. But I also realize that when we teach students, we at least have a little bit of a chance to plant the seeds, to engage them in thinking and not giving in to the easy pathways. And so we hope for the future that that will bear some fruit and make all our societies and the relationship between them better.
Hopefully, yeah. Inshallah.
Thank you for joining us. Tahir Ulic speaks out of his deep care for Turkey and for its religious life. The pathways to restoring balance in societies following periods of virulent secularization are always difficult and demanding. And there are dangerous shoals that can damage the ship of state. We need to hear his thoughts, along with those of many others. I welcome your thoughts on our discussion in this podcast and encourage you to visit our website. Details may be found in the program notes.